Okay, yes, let's make a start. Oh, welcome everybody, thanks for coming. This is the last talk of term, apart from this event that's being held in town in 2 weeks' time, which you might have heard of. I think Darren sent an email out about it. So we're having one final talk about health or some such thing in town, and then we're having a Christmas party after that, which will rather ruin everything that's been said before. So nevertheless, this is the last talk here. It's a pleasure to welcome Paul David from the University of Sussex. I never know how to introduce you, Paul, but Paul is wonderful. He writes about fiction and literature, well-known for work on Levinas, Blanchot, Heidegger, Derrida, Kant, and today we have a talk. Has it got a different title for the one?
No.
Okay, well in that case I can't remember the title, but is it Moral Asymmetry and Theism?
Yes, or Theism and Moral Asymmetry.
Excellent, so Nietzsche, Kant and Levinas.
Right, thank you very much for the invitation, and I realised rereading this on the train that I have far too much material, and Mike tells me that Levinas, he thinks, isn't someone many of you will have looked at or studied, so I was going to begin with some stuff from sort of inside Levinas's work, but I think what I'll do is rearrange it. So the idea here is to look at three philosophers whose work shares a whole series of concepts and ideas, because whatever the differences between them, the philosophical projects of Kant, Nietzsche and Levinas overlap to an extraordinary degree. Each provides an account of the world that necessitates a radically new conception of the self or subject. Each develops that account and conception alongside a thoroughgoing criticism of a prevailing moral metaphysics. Indeed, properly understood, the account of the world and the conception of the subject that each offers entail just such a criticism. And the motivations for the criticism that we can find in each of these writers can, on a generous enough definition of the word, of the term, themselves be described as moral. So this might strike you, particularly if there are any Nietzscheans here, people who feel very close to Nietzsche, but the idea that Nietzsche is a moralist might strike you as a little bit odd. But there's a sense in which Nietzsche's accusations about morality is that it hasn't made people moral. Morality has in some sense intensified human suffering, caused far more suffering. And so it's very difficult, it's very easy to find passages where in some sense what seems to be prompting Nietzsche's critique of morality, his theological investigations into morality, can be thought of as moral in some non-technical, general sense. This moral dissatisfaction, as well, is also apparent in the way each sometimes seeks to distance himself from what he perceives as an undermining or defeatist scepticism. Again, this would need quite a bit of work, but in the larger project I try and show that at various points what motivates each of them is to try and avoid a certain sort of defeatist scepticism or fatalism. So even if there is a fatalism in each, it's of a particular sort, supposedly a sort of healthy affirmative, affirming of fate, acceptance of fatalism. Now, more than any other philosophers, Kant, Nietzsche and Levinas remain convinced that an understanding of morality must also understand not only the meaning of theism. Let's say each of these three philosophers insist on revisiting the question of theism, but not as an ontological or creedal matter. They're not concerned with the existence of God, primarily, nor belief in God, primarily, but as a way of attempting finally to clarify the meaning of God. So as we're going to see, to try and get some sense of the Kantian project, we have to get some sense of what it means to encounter God as an idea. To get a sense of the Nietzschean project, we have to grasp what is meant by God as an aesthetic idea or as a value. And with Levinas, and far more provocatively, a wonderful sentence of Levinas is, God is only a word. But then he, for some people, spoils the effect by saying, albeit the first word. So more than any other philosophers then, modern philosophers, I think, modern European thinkers perhaps, Kant, Nietzsche and Levinas remain convinced that an understanding of morality must also understand not only the meaning of theism, of monotheism, and the meaning of the word God, but also why these meanings acquire such force and precedence. Each of them proposes their own way of justifying this claim. Each of them his own way of demonstrating the interplay between moral and religious language. And each of them implicitly his or their own account of why the sorts of suggestions and directions made and taken by the other two will necessarily fail. So in the broader picture, what I try and do is show that when Kant's project gets going with respect to his critique of morality and the way he reintroduces the question of God, he encounters a predicament as far as Nietzsche's concerned, and in trying to resolve that predicament by, as it were, reinvigorating or revising a different sort of critique of morality by rethinking God as a value, Nietzsche's going to encounter, run up against a predicament as far as Levinas is concerned. So I try and show how each of these projects in some sense overlap and interweave in that sense. But as I say, I probably won't have time to cover all of that this afternoon. For each of them then, when the question turns to the meaning of theism, or the ontological concerns fade into irrelevance, leaving us with God as respectively an idea of reason, an aesthetic idea or value, and a word. So let me just begin. I'm going to organise it like this. I'm going to begin by saying something about the Kantian project. And then I want to spend most of my time talking about Nietzsche's diagnosis of the predicament that Kant finds himself in. And then, time permitting, something about the predicament Nietzsche then seems to find himself in. And then introduce you to Levinas as a way of trying to respond to that predicament. But this isn't an apology for Levinas, in the sense that the solution isn't going to be Levinasianism, because I think that there can be no such thing. I think Levinas is a provocation, a fantastic reader and sort of interrupter of other people's texts, but I'm not remotely concerned with something like being a Levinasian or something like that. But we can talk more about that in the discussion if you like. So let's just some basic rehearsal of some of Kant's moves. As we know, Kant's critique of theoretical reason, the first critique, in trying to mark its own limits, its own constraints, what constrains the investigations as to what we can know, necessarily constrains what Kant calls ontotheology. That is to say, the metaphysical, theoretical investigation into the nature and existence of God. So theoretical reason, in its Kantian critique, can no longer conceive of itself as securing theism. Theism is no longer underwritten theoretically by reason. Kant's famous claim, being is not a real predicate. We'll come back to that a little bit later. And yet theoretical reason for Kant is not reason as such, or rather it's not reason in its primary use or employment. So the question of what can be claimed with respect to knowledge is a question to, for, and from a reason that is already practically engaged. So reason, theoretical reason is, the account of theoretical reason can never exhaust an account of reason, because reason is primarily practical. So the project of the second critique and the groundwork for metaphysics and morals is to clarify the essential features, the a priori features of practical reason. Now this practical reason is regulated, and that regulation, the nature of that regulation appears when it reflects on its actions, on how it should act, or how it should live. But what regulates practical reason, Kant will say, are certain ideas. These ideas have a necessary status and role to play when reflecting on practical reason. Most famously, freedom, if you had to say the most, single most influential one. For Kant, to reflect on what it is to reason practically with respect to action necessarily entails arising at the thought that reason must be free. Because only in such a way can reason give itself reasons, legislate for itself, be autonomous. And Kant insists that God is another idea, that in its practical use reason necessarily employs. And not just the idea of God, but the idea of God's existence. So a lot of people, in fact, like what Kant says about freedom and don't like what he says about God and the existence of God, but they occupy the same sort of conceptual space in Kant's practical philosophy. Now for Kant there's no problem here at all. I mean, it might be difficult, but he thinks that on the whole our moral reasoning, our everyday practical reasoning is in pretty good shape. It doesn't require the critical overhauling or overturning that theoretical reason required. Okay, so that's why we don't need this Copernican turn with respect to moral philosophy that we needed with respect to in the first critique. So there isn't a problem with that for Kant. And a certain Kantianism will just, as it were, follow through on the implications of practical reason's primacy. And will so rewrite and make sure there's space within practical reason for religion, for theism, for religious language, now construed practically or morally. However, for others, and in particular for Nietzsche, there is a predicament here. And to put it really bluntly, and I'll go through it in more detail, what's the predicament? Well, for Kant's commitment is to reason. That's the project. The project is to demonstrate how, in some sense, reason reflecting on its limits and, in some sense, accepting those critical constraints and seeing what's possible within them. But that commitment to reason and rationality first seems to sever the necessary link to theism, so undermining even the idea of a straightforwardly positive ontotheology. But then it seems to reason itself into a recapitulation to theism. So the very move, the commitment to reason, that led to what, you know, is in some sense the most thoroughgoing critical undermining of a rational theism, then at a certain point decides theism has to be allowed back in. Has to be brought back in. And so, if there's a tension between reason and theism, then reason has to be compromised for the sake of theism. As Kant says, atheism is unthinkable. So, for Nietzsche, that's going to be the predicament. The predicament is the commitment to reason gives Kant the mechanism for beginning to break the spell of a theistic metaphysics, but then, as it were, on the practical and crucially moral level, theism has to be reaffirmed, re-evaluated, and brought back in. Now, Nietzsche's response to this, I think, and I'm going to make a claim which I won't be able to make good on here, but in the larger project, try and show this. I think Nietzsche's sense of Kant's inability to break free of theism leads him to a much deeper sense of the after effects of theism. That theism is not enough, as it were, for theism to be theoretically undermined. A certain type of theism, a certain theistic, there are theistic components in our thought and our language. And it's going to require an extraordinary sort of activity of re-evaluating for us to move beyond them or to bring about something new. And there are two stages to this process. The first one, or two phases. The first one, the one I'm going to look at in some detail, is I think in his aphoristic period, sometimes called texts like the Gay Science. but you also get the famous aphorism about the death of God. And I think throughout the gay science, one of the themes linking several of the aphorisms concerns a new idea of the self. Learning to know oneself, learning to love oneself, learning to listen to oneself differently. And I think, I'll try and demonstrate this with a little bit of commentary, that Nietzsche is trying there to think the self in a way that has nothing in common with the Kantian self. Later on, however, in the genealogy of morals and the Antichrist, I think we find Nietzsche becoming increasingly convinced that it's not that, that you can't just reintroduce a new notion of the self or develop a new notion of the self. And he becomes far more, and he gives ever more graphic descriptions of just how far-reaching theism, in particular Christianity, is. And that's going to lead us to his predicament, which at the end of this, I'll at least hint at the way Levinas might diagnose it. Okay, so what I'd like to do now then is just look at one of the aphorisms. I mean, I could say an awful lot about what it is to write aphoristically and just how beautifully composed these aphorisms are. But on the handout you have an extract from quite a long aphorism, which is called Long Live Physics, or Upward Physics. And a deliberate teasing of a Kantian metaphysics. And here you have an extract. And the extract begins by saying, so how many people are there who know how to observe? And of the few who do, how many observe themselves? Everyone is furthest from themselves. Everyone who is expert at scrutinizing the inner life of others knows this to their chagrin. And the saying, know thyself, addressed to human beings by a god, is near to malice. Now there's a play here on at least two sayings, the love thy neighbour as thyself, commanded in the Gospels, and the Delphic instruction to know thyself. The neighbour, Nachbar, the nearest, der Nachbar, there's a play here, is contrasted with the self that is not the self of the neighbour, here one's own self, and actually, paradoxically, the furthest. Now, Nietzsche seems to be implying that it may be the only self we feel confident in examining and judging are those of our neighbours. Do we really discern anything clearly in our own selves? What would it be to learn to observe ourselves properly? And I think that in some of these aphorisms from the middle period, Nietzsche is really genuinely trying to set out a project. What would it be to learn to see ourselves? Would self-knowledge be the result of such an observation, or would we not have to concede the malice of a god who insisted on our seeking it? So Nietzsche then continues by talking about the desperate state of self-observation. And then he introduces this wonderful voice and says, people seem to want to say to you, why, my dear sir, this is precisely my thing, my Zaka. You have addressed your question to the person best qualified to answer it, for there's nothing I am wiser about than self-knowledge. So what Nietzsche does in this second, as the passage continues, is turn to the topic of moral action and of the self-examination that supposedly decides and confirms it in its rectitude. The expert on morality must also be an expert in self-observation. If only because a correct understanding of the former includes an appreciation of how a self is capable of the moral discrimination preceding the action. Now Nietzsche here introduces a second voice, and I tried in a previous section of this to say how carefully these are composed with different voices. Nietzsche introduces a second voice, and the aphorism begins to represent the sceptical undermining of the expert's confidence as a conversation. So why does the expert deny the status of an act or action to the judging and inferring? In other words, so if you look at the passage, he says, when a human being judges this is right, and then infers therefore it must come about, and then does what he has thus recognized as right and designated as necessary, then the essence of his action is moral. But my friend, you are speaking of three actions instead of one. For instance, your judging that this is right is also an action. Might one not judge in a moral and an immoral manner? Why do you take this, precisely this, to be right? Okay. So why does the expert deny the status of an act or action to the judging and inferring? In other words, the thinking that leads to a further act or action. What is it that makes those actions different in kind from the ones we present as their outcome or result? And then the expert says, because my conscience tells me so. And conscience never speaks immorally. Indeed, it alone determines what is to come, count as moral. Now the answer Nietzsche has the expert give here makes a familiar appeal to a special kind of inner speech, the voice of conscience. We can see now that the conversation Nietzsche is constructing between the expert and the skeptic mimics the conversation we sometimes imagine to be going on in moral deliberation. It is a matter of learning to listen to both. The problem with the skeptic's claim that there were three acts involved in what the expert took to be doing the right thing is that actions in and of themselves are morally neutral. Their rightness derives from the conversation or the listening to conscience that prompted them. It follows, whatever we take conscience to be doing, or a self to be doing when it attends to conscience, cannot itself be treated as an action. That's just going to have to be stipulated. That is, as something the rightness or wrongness of which could be disputed. But the skeptical questioning is unstoppable. It's not going to accept that conscience is just somehow self-authorized to order. But why do you listen to the words, Sprache, of your conscience? What gives you the right to consider such a judgment true and infallible? For disbelief, is there no conscience? Do you know nothing of an intellectual conscience, a conscience behind your conscience? And then it goes on to talk in sort of naturalistic terms about the prehistory of the drives and the inclinations that must impact on the conscience. Why listen to your conscience? If we're dealing here with a voice that speaks to one, then are we not entitled to adumbrate the various ways in which we might hear it? The skeptic insists that we take this metaphor seriously. There cannot be a voice that must be heard in only one fashion, that can only be responded to or interpreted in only one fashion. It is a matter of listening then, and that listening can take many forms. And if the expert eschewing the logic and the interpretive possibilities they make the that make the metaphor of the conversation intelligible and legible, nonetheless continues to claim that this is simply the way in which the voice must be heard, then that claim can also be interrogated. Okay, nothing's going to stop the skeptical questioning here. So we come to another one. The firmness, Festigkeit, of your moral judgment could be evidence of your personal wretchedness or lack of personality. Your moral strength might have its source in your stubbornness or in your inability to envisage new ideals. And to be brief, had you thought more acutely, observed better and learned more, you would no longer continue to call this duty of yours and this conscience of yours duty and your conscience. And here we come to a crucial point for Nietzsche. Your understanding of how moral judgments originate would make you tired of these pathetic words, as you have already grown tired of other pathetic words. For example, sin, salvation, and redemption. Here we have Nietzsche saying, look, religious language, you've already thought yourself beyond that, but your new vocabulary, duty, conscience, has the same character. Now Kant's going to say exactly the same thing. That's the way he's going to bring the religious language back in. Okay, so here you have Nietzsche and Kant, as it were, observing the same mood, but with very different judgments on it. Now, I think, and this is where I differ from quite a lot of readers of Nietzsche's, that Nietzsche's the voice of the text, if you like, can't be simply identified with the skeptical voice here. Because there's a hectoring or triumphalist quality to the skeptic's voice here. The positivistic insistence that by now we all know that obviously theological notions such as sin, salvation and redemption can do no productive or useful work. the defender of duty and conscience on pain of inconsistency, will also have to defend this outmoded and explicitly theological vocabulary. Well, perhaps we could bring in someone to explicitly defend it. So now the voice becomes one you'll recognise, or at least the target. Now, my friend, do not cite the categorical imperative. This term tickles my ear and makes me laugh. It makes me think of old Kant, who had a dream. He's often old Kant, for Nietzsche. Old Kant, who had obtained the thing in itself by stealth, and was punished for this when the categorical imperative crept stealthily into his heart and led him astray, back to God, soul, freedom, and immortality, like a fox who loses his way and goes astray back into his cage. Yet it had been his strength and cleverness that had broken open the cage. What, you admire the categorical imperative within you? This absoluteness of the feeling that here everyone must judge as I do, admire rather your selfishness. Okay, I won't read the whole thing, but it's worth it. Any hope that a transcendental treatment of conscience would temper the sceptical questioner is quickly disavowed. The Kantian attempt to mark conscience as that constitutive feature of practical rationality, which raises moral deliberation to the level of the universal, is no more than another piece of special pleading. So when I say this is right, I'm not only saying this is right for me, nor am I only saying that this is right for everyone. I'm also saying that the I asserting the rightness of an action has a universal endorsement and speaks in the voice of the universal. The conscience, my conscience, is not merely my conscience. And when I answer to it, I'm not merely this particular individual in these particular circumstances. But is not this the ultimate selfishness, to exempt myself from any further challenge by claiming a status which need not submit to any further challenge? So if I claim to be speaking in the name of the universal, what any rational being must will, then in some sense I exempt myself. That's my alibi, as it were, from having to face any further criticism. And so when... Okay, I'm going to skip a bit because it's taking a little bit longer, but the dominance of the sceptical voice in this aphorism tempts the reader again to a quick conclusion. For is not this voice clearly that of the author, and is its name not the very reduction or reductio on Kant's moral vocabulary we find elsewhere in Nietzsche's work? Okay, so now against the metaphysics for which the self is essentially different from anything that is not a self whose origin is miraculous and supernatural, Nietzsche posits a self that can claim no such essence, and whose thoughts and concerns, beliefs and desires belong necessarily to a series of subconscious or unconscious processes and drives that are as available for physical investigation as any other event or state of affairs. If we decide to call some of these thoughts, concerns and beliefs moral, and I think Nietzsche is not in principle opposed to our doing so, there will always remain much that could be said about that decision and about its history, and the history of all such decisions, and of the decision to gather all such decisions together. The sceptical voice, the aphorism and Nietzsche all seem to bring the reader to the realisation that against metaphysics, and especially Kantian metaphysics, metaphysics in its critical renewal, there is nothing special about the self. That would be, if you take the sceptical voice of the aphorism, that's the conclusion you come to. There's nothing special about the self. Okay, the self is nothing special. But what might make us hesitate to leave the aphorism with this reading is not, as it was with the earlier one that I read reading in the previous chapter. It's the opening questions. So this aphorism, 335, moves us quickly into the parodic staging of the encounter from an expert and sceptic, where much of the content of the sceptic's speech is itself a parodying and ridiculing of the encounter between the self and its conscience. There's a complex doubling of the conversation here. If we, the readers, are immediately convinced that the sceptic is right, and that nothing the moral expert says, or the one who claims or who seeks self-knowledge says, could possibly be of interest to the sceptic, and by extension giving our identifying of the sceptical voice with the authorial voice of the aphorism, could possibly be of interest to Nietzsche or to us, then this conversation, as much as the one it mimics, centres on a voice that knows itself to be right. Okay, so if you read this positivistically, where the sceptical voice is identified with Nietzsche, then there's a sort of victory in seeing the poor person who's trying to understand itself coming to nothing. But it might, just such a triumphalist reading should give us pause, because the aphorism operates with three pairs of interlocutors, the self and its conscience, the expert and the sceptic, the aphorism and the reader. On the immediate reading, the sceptic and reader join forces in rejecting the self-authority of conscience. Collaborating in this way, the reader now concludes that the aphorism itself does no more than confirm a scepticism about the self and its moral reasoning. It is uncontroversially anti-Kantian. And really, when one considers it, the objections to Kant are actually quite familiar. They're not particularly new. But this doesn't sound too right either. Okay. So, I mean, it doesn't sound as if the care with which Nietzsche writes this work requires this sort of very straightforward interpretation. Okay, but recall the opening sentences. So how many people are there who know how to observe? And of the few who do, how many observe themselves? Everyone is furthest from themselves. Everyone who is expert at scrutinizing the inner lives of others knows this. Now, does this sound like the introduction to an aphorism aimed solely at reinforcing the insignificance of the self? I'm going to try and suggest that, the aphorism wouldn't be written as carefully as it is if the purpose is to ridicule the thought that there's anything special about the self. Rather, what it's trying to do is to prepare a sort of, almost to try and teach the reader to listen to the self differently, to listen to the self that she or he is differently. That's the way I'm going to try and interpret it. So here we have a project, I think, that Nietzsche is embarking on in his aphorist philosophy, where he's trying to come up with his own conception of the self, a new way of experiencing the self, of engaging in the self, of listening to the self, and elsewhere he talks about loving the self, love thyself. But he has to distance it from the Kantian project. And I think the reason why he has to do that is because of the depth of the theistic commitment in the Kantian project, and I will say a bit more about that. So I give a variety of interpretations, but the one I want to come to now is where I look at this is taking longer. There's something about the half light as well, the atmosphere of the labour chapel.
Take it off.
Well, no, I'm not. I can't. It's not only my time. Okay. So the thought here is that Nietzsche's rejection and ridiculing and undermining and parodying of Kant cannot be separated from Kant's theism. It has everything to do with Kant's reintroducing and returning to a vocabulary he more than anyone was instrumental in undermining. So I think, again, there's lots of evidence in another text of Nietzsche's, I think, to this effect, that Kant is the philosopher who, in some sense, more than any other modern philosopher, undermines theism. And he's the philosopher who, more than any other philosopher, reinstates it at the heart of moral and practical life. Well, he likens him to Luther. Okay? For Nietzsche, Luther goes, sees the corruption of the papacy and makes precisely draws the wrong conclusion. He thinks Christianity has to be reformed, whereas Nietzsche thinks, look, it's decadent, it's over, it's corrupt. Okay, so let me just give you an example of how I think it works. raised. I'll read a little bit of this. So it is tempting but misleading to see Nietzsche's undertaking as a straightforwardly sceptical or neo-Humean one. Some Nietzschean scholars do that. And to conceive of his anti-Kantianism as an empirical, sceptical rejection of the positivity of the rationalist critique of metaphysics. For Nietzsche, Hume denies the philosophical legitimacy of notions such as self and cause, so can have little time for a project such as Kant's that seeks to delimit the realm within which they make sense and can be used productively. To this extent, Kant is actually more sympathetic. Nietzsche is more sympathetic to Kant. Because I, in my reading, Nietzsche thinks we need to think the self, to take the self seriously. So Kant's, it's hard, I think, to underestimate the force of the Kantian decision to reinstall theism in the development of Nietzsche's critical investigations into deism and subjectivity and morality. Because in a crucial sense, it uniquely proves the power of theism and of the moral theistic interpretation of the world. To this end, it is vital for Nietzsche that Kant's theism and retention of theism are serious. And this is why I don't think, say, people like Dawkins and Grayling will say, Kant wasn't really a theist, he's an atheist, really. Because they want a simple story about enlightenment, rationality, and the rise of secular science. And Kant's a good person on the good side, so he's got to say atheism is unthinkable because it's important for his job, his livelihood. He's got to do that. He's got to pay lip service to theism. But he's not seriously theistic. Nietzsche has a much subtler reading of it, namely that theism is not so easily overcome. And when Kant reinstalls it, he's pointing to something. I mean, Kant thinks we can't think without theism. And Nietzsche thinks, on one reading, that's right, but we have to try and think of ourselves in such a way that we might be able to. It's a long, long-term project. Looking ahead millennia, maybe. Okay. So Kant's re-evaluation of theism, cognition and reason is indicative of the way theism revalues itself in and through its engagements with anything that confronts it. So Kant's critique of theism is a decisive event in the ongoing history of theism. That's, I think, going to be Nietzsche's key point. For Nietzsche, the only real reputation of theism can be a historical one. And there are moments in which it's implied that it's already happened when he talks about the language of sin and salvation. But Nietzsche, I think, is increasingly drawn to complex ways in which theism lives on beyond its refutation, or better, beyond its encounters with anything that might refute, qualify, or check it. So, let me say something about why I think the Kantian notion of the self that Nietzsche is desperately trying to deconstruct, dismantle and think beyond, and perhaps even re-evaluate and find another notion of the self, why it remains essentially theistic or bound up with a theistic reasoning for Nietzsche. Kant's analysis and treatment of arguments for the existence of God emphasizes the foundational role played by the ontological argument. In other words, the classical theistic proofs reduced to the ontological argument, Kant's move, which in turn erroneously makes existence a real rather than a purely logical predicate. So the ontological argument says of one being that it and it alone exists necessarily. In this one instance, being is a real predicate, and this one being exists of necessity, an exceptional being, an exceptional predicate, an exceptional instantiation and application of the predicate. And Kant denies these exceptionalities, or at least denies that reason can underwrite them or come to any knowledge of them. Showing that, with respect to being, one cannot venture logically and rationally beyond possibility. You can't. I mean, I gather people have been looking at that a lot, but we can talk about it in questions. Now, what does this have to do with practical reason? You might say, okay, but that's for theoretical reason. a practical reason, has got nothing to do with this. Well, let me try something else for you. Yeah, but the charge of the critical theoretical undermining of the ontological argument was not itself explicitly ontological. If it demonstrated anything, it was something about reason. It didn't demonstrate that God didn't exist. I always quite liked the image of God sort of... You know, sometimes in the Old Testament, God is sort of... the people, the children of Israel, are always wandering around in the wilderness and they're forever murmuring. Murmuring is a wonderful word in King James. Because God's always getting what? You can't hear what they're saying. He's not actually saying anything, they're just murmuring. So he's always calling someone to come, Moses or someone to come. What are the people saying? And Moses has to say that they're pretty pissed off or something. So I always quite like this idea that God, sort of imagining God saying, what are the philosophers saying now? And someone says, well, they've just said that being isn't a real predicate. Well, what's that mean? It means you can't exist necessarily. But of course, it doesn't mean that, because it's not an ontological phrase. So what is it doing? If it demonstrated anything, it was something about reason and the inability of reason to arise cognitively at an exceptional being, a self-authorizing being, a self-causing being. So the thesis about being warned against the misuse of the existential predicate in arguments for the reality of this self-authorizing author. But in the groundwork and the critique of practical reason, Kant distinguishes between the hypothetical and categorical imperatives, where the former is the feature of means-end reasoning, and the latter the feature of a thought that can go no further, an imperative permitting no further investigation, that coalesces around a conclusion simply through its being the exception to means-end reasoning. Think of conscience in that. Right. Conscience is supposed to be self-authorizing, so it's the end of the series. You get no further than conscience. So the skeptic says, but why is this conscience? Why can't I challenge conscience? Conscience is exceptional. It's self-legislating. It's an exceptional imperative that it appeals to or embodies. Okay, so now it looks as if, here we might say, that the categorical imperative asserts and embodies an exceptional ought, an ought that authorizes itself, and that by virtue of that exceptional authority constrains reason and the rational self. So is the common element then between the ontotheology from which the critique of theoretical reason would have discouraged us, and the practical domain protected and prioritized by that critique, precisely not this insistence on exceptionality? An exceptional being, an exceptional imperative. In both cases, it is an exceptionality that constrains and defines the self. And in both cases, that constrained self is obligated, created, sinful, guilty, and brought willingly, on pain of irrationality, to reverence. And if you know the Kant's extraordinary descriptions of the moral law, that reason feels this respect for the moral law, this awe, this reverence. It's this thing that's sort of inner worship almost. So here I think we can begin to discern what it is that profoundly irritates Nietzsche and Kant's theistic continuity. Here we can begin to see what this continuity means for Nietzsche. So is the presumption then that what Nietzsche wants is a removal of this metaphysical and theistic exceptionality? There's nothing exceptional about the self, nothing exceptional about anything. Well, that's one way of taking it, but I don't think that can be right. I don't think it can be right at all. Because I think that Nietzsche's trying to find another way of thinking about the exceptional. And I'm going to... We can come back to this if you like, but this would be a way of characterising. But what I just wanted to bring out was that the Kantian, in Kant's practical philosophy, something like the notion of exceptionality that Nietzsche thinks has been demystified and, as it were, shown to be illegitimate with respect to theoretical reason is still operating in this language of the categorical imperative, conscience, and the heart of the moral self in Kant. Okay, I'm just... all right, let me... how long have I got?
Maybe 10 minutes.
10 minutes, okay, good. All right, so that I take it, is that's my... The gay science is my favourite of Nietzsche. I'm not a Nietzschean. I find myself a little bit disturbed by the Nietzsche we're going to come on now, the Nietzsche of the predicament. But I think the gay science, I think, in some sense, is Nietzsche still thinking that it might be possible to, as it were, develop and read and begin to attend to a notion of the self other than the Kantian self, and rethink the exceptional. There's a wonderful passage which is in the posthumous notebooks, which I will read out, because it's where Nietzsche thinks that we really do need to rethink exceptionality. That what is exceptional in a self, ourselves and other selves, is not going to be godlike or conscience or soul. But so this is a fragment from 1880. The fantastic and delirious pathos from which we have valorized the most exceptional acts has as its counterpart the absurd indifference and contempt with which we treat obscure and everyday actions. We are the dupes of rarity, and we have thus deprecated even our daily bread. So there's a very different Nietzsche, right? That's not the Nietzsche of a Nietzschean heroics. This is the Nietzsche who says, we're incapable of understanding and appreciating what's exceptional about the most ordinary things, because we have this exceptional exceptionality, which is God or the soul or the divine in the human or conscience or something like that. So this is the Nietzsche who's trying to retrieve another notion of the self, and an exceptionality that, as it were, inheres in the most ordinary of things. However, as we've seen, and if this is right, Nietzsche thinks, has been brought to this, what's motivating this is just how deeply the theistic impulse and the after effects of theism are in the Kantian project. Now, this means that however astute Nietzsche's psychological appreciation of the after effects of theism, and in particular Judeo-Christian monotheism, may be, there seems increasingly no way in which can trigger or contribute to the establishing of an alternative. And this is the point I want to make, and then have a little Levinasian epilogue. That sounds a bit too religious. Conclusion. Okay, so for Nietzsche, the creation of, or the coming about of theism, and in particular Christian theism, which he examines firstly in terms of the ascetic ideal, and secondly in the Antichrist in his reading of St. Paul, St. Paul's conversion and teaching. The creation of what he will also call the moral interpretation of the world is so extraordinary an achievement that the character and content of either an alternative creation or the creation of an alternative and new value can seem unimaginable and impossible. So whereas Nietzsche in his earlier writings and in Moments in Gay Science seems to think it's possible to find a counterweight to the Kantian self, or a counterweight with respect to the ethics and history, for example. There's a sort of Aristotelianism in some of those early and mid-period Nietzsche texts. A certain balance is still possible. In his descriptions of the ascetic ideal and the genealogy and the event of that inaugurates Christianity in the Antichrist, he's describing something that's so overwhelming in its significance that it's almost impossible to imagine a counterbalance to it, a way of, as it were, escaping its effects. So this is going to bring us to the predicament. So there has never been a moment in world history as successful or as transformative as this simple and initially obviously false affirmation, I in my weakness and wretchedness am good. This is the moment that the genealogy of moral talks about, where, as it were, good is associated with the weak. This is the beginning of the cleverest idea ever introduced or created. Because here the lack of power and possibility and the having of nothing are transformed into the sweetest and most powerful of possessions, a divine being chosen. And here, as the first essay of the genealogy argues, good, construed as divinely good, finds its relevant contrast with evil rather than bad. This moment serves as a speculative installation into history and language of that animal, as Nietzsche will call it, whose cleverness enables it to thrive and to continue to proclaim its poverty, even as over the centuries it convinces and converts the richest and most powerful individuals, institutions and states. So thus, Christianity continues, not despite its confrontations with movements, doctrines and faiths that would temper or undermine it, but precisely because it takes each such confrontation as a reason to reform and revalue itself as still Christian. So, Nietzsche at different times will talk about the Nietzschean encounter with Islam. Instead of encountering something new and becoming something different, on Nietzsche's reading, Christianity becomes a crusading religion. The Renaissance, the Enlightenment, modernity, in each of these phases, Christianity, as it were, is challenged, runs up against something that seems to be its other or its opposite, and, as it were, re-evaluates itself in the face of that opposition. So even when its contemporary challenge, the Christian and Christianity indicted for absurdity, and for the ridiculous of thinking that they continue, the terms of the indictment are themselves Christianized. They're rendered theological. Yes, the Christian replies, yes, Christianity is absurd. And it will continue in its absurdity. Okay, so there's no... I don't know if you follow any of these New Atheist debates, but there's sometimes terribly funny watching someone like Daniel Dennett, who says, he just doesn't understand. He says, surely the Christians have got to admit now that it's all just absurd. But I tell them it's absurd, and they say, this is very helpful. It is absurd, yes. This is what theology is telling us. And I think Nietzsche, I mean, I'm not saying this is right about Christianity, but I think Nietzsche wants to see this as the history of Christianity is the history of something which, as it were, cannot be undone. Not by Judaism, not by Islam, not by... So in the Antichrist, he tries to understand how this is possible. And he does it, in the Antichrist, by giving an extraordinary reading of the conversion of Paul, where something which is geographically, historically, culturally, linguistically specific, supposedly the teachings of a Palestinian Jew at a particular point in history, are actually universalized. So that it's going to be possible to encounter a spiritual Christ anywhere, at any time, anywhere in the world, and any time in history. So Nietzsche sees this moment, this absolute universalizing of this singular moment into the ubiquity, the potential ubiquity of a spiritual Christ, a resurrected Christ. Paul doesn't encounter anything other than what you call the resurrected Christ, as the moment of a sort of almost overwhelming success of an idea. So now we have a situation, there's the predicament. The predicament is that Nietzsche has gone from trying to think a notion of the self that might be an alternative, something new, to such, I mean, I need as long as I have on that aphorism to try and demonstrate this, to such a sort of profound account, such a devastating account of the profound effects of the ascetic ideal, and particularly Christianity, that it looks as if no counterweight or balance or escape is going to be possible. Now, this needn't be a predicament for Nietzsche and for certain Nietzscheans, because they're going to say that's right, and that's why the Nietzschean analysis of nihilism, Christianity is thought as nihilistic for Nietzsche, is something that continues. One can't, as it were, simply affirm an alternative and announce something new. That's why this is something Howard Cagle and I were talking about. He thinks that Zarathustra's teaching is the teaching of a series of failed doctrines, and the project itself is a project that fails. It can't succeed, because if it succeeds, it's going to be one more positive thing that theism Christian theism is going to be able to, as it were, re-evaluate itself over and against. So Nietzsche's project becomes increasingly, whereas just as Kant reasoned reason into a sort of capitulation to theism, Nietzsche has to sort of revalue value. The project, as he endlessly announces and scribbles, and it remains unfinished, the re-evaluation of all values. That the Antichrist is a sort of part of that project. But it's so compelling, and it's what it describes is so overwhelming, it's hard to see how that re-evaluation can take place. Now, really, let's bring him on just at the last minute. Levinas thinks this is a predicament, and he thinks it's a predicament that is a sort of madness, because it allows... Levinas is someone who said very nicely, I've always thought, in May 1968, he said the blasphemy in Paris in the 60s was to blaspheme against Nietzsche's God is Dead. There was nothing blasphemous about Nietzsche. Nietzsche didn't blaspheme. No one was offended by Nietzsche. But they were offended by anyone who was blasphemed against Nietzsche. What Levinas tries to suggest is that what we need, so we need a new notion of the subject. That notion of the subject has to be bound up, because it cannot be otherwise than admitting the continued significance of God, the word God, and for Levinas it's only a word. So what does Levinas do? Well, let me just hint at it. Levinas suggests that the self, if the ascetic ideal is seen as a value created by a self of resentment, ressentiment, then that's precisely what's overwhelming. So Nietzsche thinks, think of the subject differently. Think of the subject not as a self that creates, or a self that evaluates, or a self that, as it were, interprets itself into bondage, guilty, or whatever. But think of the self as simply for the other, to the other. So instead of the interior Kantian project, or the desperate attempt, as Nietzsche, as Levinas would see it, to find a new self to avoid the Kantian interior self, think of the self as radical exteriority, as open to the other. So now, what Levinas says is, the word God, don't think of the word God as a word that reason has to use in the context of reflecting on its own moral freedom. But also don't think of it as a value created by a self from which another future self will have to try and liberate it. Think of God as only a word, but a name that, if it names something, always names one that's closer to the other than to me. So Levinas thinks that the dilemma comes about because the self, the unique self, sets itself up in a unique relation with a unique being, God, and nothing can, as it were, everything else can happen as a function of that, but that's going to be the beginning. So, for example, whether it be for Christianity or in the Kantian context, what one loves, what one respects in the other is either God in the other or the moral law that the other has access to just as I have access to. So Levinas tries to introduce a radical asymmetry where subjectivity is somehow from the first for the other. And this leads to a whole series of claims, interesting claims. And he has a wonderful reading of the moment in Genesis where Abraham is at prayer and he's interrupted by three strangers, and Levinas says this is the only answer to prayer you ever get. Someone interrupts you and you have to make them welcome. So this is so now it's simply become, I mean, I need to go into this in far more detail, but Levinas thinks that what we need then is a notion of the self which is, as it were, interrupted. And it can only be interrupted if it thinks of itself as, in some primary sense, for the other, already responding to and for the other. And in an interesting essay on Simone Weil, he says that the inner life would suffice if there wasn't suffering. So the only way you can sustain the priority of the interiority and the individual's relationship with the individual's own God would be by, as it were, justifying the suffering of the other, either by a theodicy, in some sense by making. And Levinas, as much as Nietzsche, is going to be critical of all those tendencies. Levinas, as much as Kant, is going to be critical of that privileging of a sort of mystical prayer, a prayer simply of the self to its God. So there are other overlappings to come, but I just wanted to say that for Levinas, the Nietzschean predicament is a predicament which is literally unresolvable unless you introduce another asymmetry, namely the asymmetry in which the self as such, I as such, and for the other. So Levinas's projects, at least some in his later writings, right, attempts to rewrite and re-describe subjectivity as this asymmetry. That's too great. I would need as long on Levinas as I was allowed on Nietzsche, but I'll stop there.
Thank you.
Turn it off, or do you like to keep it
going? Can we keep going? Okay.
As long as we're allowed to stamp on it.
Whatever you like. Okay, so thanks a lot. It's great. Does anyone have any questions?
The slow death is also a living, is the continuing. So if I'm right, I mean, there's nothing wrong with what you said, but if I'm right, Nietzsche is the first person to sort of, I think, with a sense of psychological astuteness, to see something like the after effects of theism, of religious belief. So to actually discern that there's something, as it were, inherently religious about a whole series of concepts and terms, and maybe interested in the very structure, subject-predicate structure of sentences he seems to say at one point. In which case, this slow death of Christianity, you're right, could take millennia. So what else can happen? The Nietzsche of the early work thought that, I mean, for a while, that there could be a rebirth of tragedy. It wasn't happening for his father. The Nietzsche in the history essay thought you could balance, you can distinguish between various types of history and ask whether history can serve life, and it can if we get the right balance. And I think in the gay science, why it's ambiguous role, you get this confident idea that there can be a new conception of the self that we could love, and a growing awareness that in reintroducing theism, Kant wasn't, as it were, just doing something perverse or illogical, but that was the very motor of the aesthetic idea. That's how it works. That's what re-evaluation is in its theistic context. So how can you get to this other re-evaluation? I mean, it looks as if it's so subtle. And that's why some people think that the only solution is for Nietzsche to become Christian. Has anyone understood better than Nietzsche the extraordinary depths of Christianity? And so now put like that, of course, there's two ways of responding. One, you could respond in a way someone like Heidegger would, which would say, well, look, Nietzsche's dilemma is the dilemma at the end of a tradition. So that Nietzsche's, it's precisely end, in the sense you say, and so then Heidegger's going to try and think the tradition from Plato to Nietzsche, loosely, in a particular way. Others try and say, well, then the Nietzschean project continues in this very subtle project of writing, diagnosing, nihilism, always aware that it can't exempt itself from a certain nihilism. Levinas sees that as a predicament. Sorry.
Okay.
Yes.
Thanks, really, very much for the really faculty paper. I was just reengaging with Kant, which everyone was doing at the moment.
Yeah.
I think it's really, really great. But I just wonder, I think my, there's probably a number of questions, but I think one I'd like to ask is, what is extreme theism that's in question here, or whether it's something else, and whether any of them, if it's something other than theism, whether it's any of them, Nietzsche or Levinas, indeed, whether they get away from any more than Kant. Because you know, it seems to me that if you look at the first critique of the world, which is probably the most theistic of all the critiques in some way, what he wants to be in Greek and Greek are not the Christian God, it's some sort of successful ground. The world, the original God exists there, which grounds the world as considered as a perfect whole. And he cannot specify what it is, certainly not Christian God, because he's proved God's existence in the Greek philosophy. But he's talking beyond the world, the phenomenal world, the natural world, the world that we can know. He's something beyond it. But it's something that doesn't call that ground. And I just wonder whether, in some way, whether any, whether it's either Nietzsche or Levinas, or the way to read them, whether they get away from that notion, and whether it's even possible to get away from that notion.
Mm-hmm.
If we, in any way, counting, if we don't want to go back to Spinoza, for example, being aware of God's nature, there was God there.
Yes.
And just one last thing I would like to write in. You could say that when Nietzsche's in your reading, when Nietzsche's Christianity and all these other religions, you'd say, well, that's very Christocentric.
Mm.
And, you know, it depends how you characterize all these. You've got to characterize them in a certain way that may not necessarily be that. If you were to start from Islam, for example, you might come up with a very Islamic view.
Yes. I think that's right. I think that, no, that's helpful. Just on that last point, in his later writings on religion, Derrida made a really interesting point that on a certain understanding of religion, Christianity is the only religion. In the sense that the religion that, as it were, declares itself to be non-linguistically, non-culturally, non-historically specific in its Pauline version, and that's not dissimilar to Nietzsche. So Islam, and what would be fascinating about Islam is that it's you know, the absolute centrality of the language of the Quran to the Quran. So there's a theology of the letter, there's a specificity. So there may be some way of sort of saying that problem is going to be something like, or the possibility is going to be something about the nature of Christianity. I think about the third critique is a really interesting text to bring in here, because I think on Nietzsche's terms, that's going to be remain straightforwardly part of a sort of ascetic idealism that, in appealing to a supersensible, whether it be a felt supersensible, is going to be still not yet giving us a thoroughgoing critique of purpose, which is what he thinks we need. And with respect to I think Levinas thinks that that theism isn't a problem. I mean, Kant thinks theism isn't a problem as long as it's religion within the bounds of reason alone. Religion, as it were, thought morally. And I think Levinas, in some sense, what Levinas quite likes about, what seems central to Levinas' understanding of the Judaic tradition is the sense of loving the Torah more than God. So God is only a word, it's a word in a text to be interpreted and argued about. And one of the rules that he's interested in is the idea that if God names a being, if we take God's name of being in the text, it names one who's always closer to the other. But I don't know, I mean, I'd love to talk to you more about the third critique, because I increasingly think that there's a sort of subtext, particularly in the critique of teleological judgment, where Kant is really worried by Spinoza. You know, that, and so when you said, unless one goes to Spinoza, I think that Kant and Nietzsche, in different ways, as of course all German philosophy do, thought, I mean, for Kant, Spinoza is a threat, and for Nietzsche, I think Spinoza is a sort of inspiration. Sorry, this is a proper answer to the question.
I think I can ask a question. It's not very well formulated. It's just, I think it's quite as much about the genealogy of morality as I thought you perhaps might. And I just wondered if I could pick up a different strand in that might... Well, I'd like to see how you deal with it, because in a certain way, I think there might be more of a sense in Nietzsche that the self is formed by means of a relation to the other, which... makes him sound slightly closer to Levinas than maybe you were suggesting. In the sense that, I mean, if his story, he has a genealogy of the formation of the self in the genealogy of morality, where it's about a difference in power. So one has a power relation to a more powerful other who represses the one who is somehow physically weaker, and that causes the reversal in the direction of the instincts, which creates reflexivity, which is selfhood. So in other words, there's a genealogy of selfhood or reflexivity in the genealogy itself, and that's premised on a preceding, something like an ontology where you have a difference in power between two instances, and it has to be asymmetrical. If there isn't a higher degree of power on one side, you know, you don't get formation of a self, I think, and you don't get conscience and all the stuff that goes with it and resentment and all that. And I think one could also bring in the idea that Nietzsche thinks of law in that way as well, as if somehow, you know, genealogy of morality is the text about the origin of law and the way law, when it's imposed upon the weaker, causes that reflexing to happen. I just wondered where that fits into your account of Nietzsche's trying to rethink the self or giving up on that project and that.
Well, I suppose, I mean, in a way, this is too quick, but I suppose I do think that the genealogy is the text where, in some sense, Nietzsche thinks it's not going to be possible in the way he thought it might have been possible in the earlier books of the Gay Science and certainly something like the History Essay. And the positivism you find perhaps in Human or to Human. I think he thinks that the account of the self that the genealogist gives is not going to be an account that's going to, as it were, lead easily to a project that tries to think the self differently. So there'd be one reading, and maybe this is a reading you like, which would treat the self, Either one actually, in some sense, needs to think away from the very notion of the self, or one has to think of the self as always, as it were, bound up with a history around this, you know, these power differentials, these forces, and the self then as a function of that struggle. But I was interested in the way you used asymmetry there, because I think that to Kant, there is this interesting interior asymmetry in this account of the moral law, where reason reasons to the moral law and is then in some sense in awe of what of the law that is its own law.
Mm-hmm.
But the scene Kant describes is one of a certain reverence. Levinas thinks that Levinas and Kant both think that we need to recontextualize the reverence, which is the individual speaking to the individual's God, which they think is problematic philosophically and theologically. But Levinas does it, as I say, with the asymmetry between self and other. And it looks then, the way you're putting it, that the Nietzschean project of learning to love as a self, learning to accept a self, is going to be sort of doomed. And then the problem is, well, then what you're going to get is ever richer, ever more profound genealogies, where the genealogist is never going to be, where the genealogy is always going to be also the genealogy of the genealogy. And where will anything new come from? Where will anything different come from? What will be... So then my question to you would be, well, when Nietzsche then finally comes to the question of the value of value, which of course is the moment when Heidegger thinks that, then you see the word for being in Nietzsche. But when you get that moment, do you think that's a continuation of the genealogical project, or do you think it's the moment where Nietzsche thinks... I don't know.
Yes, well, I know, because I think that with that moment of when reflexivity or the self is formed, that's what creates a new kind of exceptionality, as you put it, because it creates the human as an exceptional animal, in the sense that, you know, Nietzsche says that's when the human being becomes interesting and present with the future.
Yeah.
And that future will be something like a revaluation of values or a moving beyond the human. But so I think the very project of a reevaluation or of something that would open up the future, that only comes about when you have this moment that the genealogy traces. So in other words, Nietzsche has nothing against it. Nietzsche thinks it was vital that formation of self happened, because otherwise man would never have become interesting. And I think so. In other words, the genealogical project, insofar as it traces the origin of the self, that does make possible later the project of a re-evaluation. I don't know if it gives much guidance on how to do that re-evaluation,
but
I think it opens it up, because it opens up the human as this exceptional entity, this exceptional animal. And it's exceptional because it has a future in a way that no other species does.
Yes. I think that's right. But to the extent that this history is very quickly coextensive with the history of Christianity, then the question arises, given that Nietzsche is not going to allow himself the Hegelian temptation to posit a sort of an end where, as it were, it's finally realised historically, and given that anything that were to present itself as the final historical end of Christianity is going to be the very spur that allows it to continue, then it just looks like the dilemma. And Levinas and Kant, interestingly, share something, which they think, well, you have to interpret it ethically. So Kant thinks you re-describe religious language as a moral language. You see, Nietzsche thinks you do that, but it's a terrible thing. And that for Levinas, you actually almost build into it this sort of ethics as first philosophy, where religious language then is a language that serves the other, not me. And what Levinas and Nietzsche will share, which I think, to a certain, no one else I've ever come across does really, maybe Spinoza, is that suffering is meaningless, is useless. And there's something terrible about a moral interpretation of the world gives a meaning to suffering. Where the suffering there is the other suffering. So the only suffering that Levinas seems to allow is meaningful is my suffering, but my suffering is just suffering because of the other suffering. That's to say, if you can't bear the other suffering, I don't know, I don't want to get too I know you don't like these You're inclined to go psychoanalytical at these points where pathos, too much pathos. But I think there's that, you see, that's what I mean by these interesting overlaps as well.
This is a small one. In terms of the American Revolution, what is small term Felix and Felix and the third party?
Yes.
My understanding of it is that it's really concerned with the conceptual priority, the development of the priority, which arguably plays both the theoretical and the practical. And then just follow on that point, and avoid many place of privacy on practical.
Yes.
And I was just wondering whether there are other reasons where they see the two third way of the second step in the critique of judgment, you know, the two dimensions of which, you know, God or
Okay, so good. So from the standpoint of the third critique, the question arises, which is something like a question, why do we need a third critique? Why wasn't this enough? So that's exactly right, and you're right that from the standpoint of the third critique, one does re-examine aspects of both theoretical and practical. But in the context, if you think of the first critique, what you have is something like What's required is this sort of this investigation into all the instruments and tools and faculties reason has at its disposal to ask how they can be used productively with respect to cognition. And what prompts that project is in part, and this is where the Copernican Revolution thing comes in, of course, is that the underlying assumption behind pre-critical metaphysics is that the question is, does thought apprehend being, or absolute reality, or the object? And skepticism arises inevitably because it looks as if thought can never know that it has. So Kant's claim is, if you examine reason critically, you will see that actually the conditions for the possibility of objective knowledge, reason is involved in those as well. Okay, so then you've got the whole chunk of the first critique, which is the transcendental dialectic, where, you know, in some sense he's showing, look how you go wrong, look how how reason goes wrong when it reasons theoretically. We don't get anything like that in the Critique of Practicals. We don't need a transcendental dialectic of that sort, because he thinks moral reasoning doesn't go wrong. So to an extent, our moral reasoning is in pretty good shape. Moral common sense is pretty good. When we worry about what we ought to do, we're looking for a binding ought, and there is a binding ought. So what the groundwork and the second critique tries to do is, in some sense, prepare the way for a metaphysics of perfectly... So that's what I meant by the sense that the revolution that needed with respect to theoretical reason isn't needed with respect to
I understand that in practical reason, then, really can go wrong, because if you use experience as a basis for testing laws. But I don't see how that, I don't see, well, but the difference between them, then, the practical reason and theoretical reason, is that theoretical reason has no experience to ground its justification. But I don't necessarily see the difference in time, maybe, or the putting up between them.
Okay, so the difference is with respect to, say, so think about, I mean, so let's say the second critique and the groundwork are concerned with action. So what can reason sort of reason about its actions? And what we then find in both the groundwork and the second critique is a slightly easing of the restriction on the positive use of noumenal, right? So we are allowed to talk about freedom as the causality of the intelligible world. We are allowed to, as it were, think of the noumenal self practically as something more than the quasi-logical transcendental function it was given in the first critique. So it looks then as if we've got a practical metaphysics which is in place, and That doesn't need to give rise to scepticism, and that doesn't need to. But in the case of the first critique, because we are concerned with what we're entitled to claim as knowledge, where most of what we're entitled to claim as knowledge is knowledge of nature, it just seems to me that I don't know, maybe I'm seeing the difference as so clear cut, and you're putting your finger on. Because the fact that reason, I mean, of course, the first critique gives us an account of experience and gives us an account of the form experiences must take. Gives us a criticism of a tradition that thought there was a faculty that could, as it were, intuit intellectually. But we don't need that sort of criticism in the second critique.
Well,
that's
different reason, because action precedes spirit and creates practice. That if the action itself is able to justify the a priori claim, well, no one can doubt you're free if you create and legislate your own action. But it seems in the first case, because there is no action or spirit,
mm-hmm.
the ground of pure reason, it seems that that's why it becomes metaphysical at one point, but then dialogue, like you say, is then both trying to show the problem in that thing. It's not really.
That's right. That's right.
So, yeah, I see it as the same principle being used in two different ways. I mean, although action obviously gets priority in one, it seems that the reason action is interpreted the same way because it's possible. Beyond it.
But why do you think the first critique is so long compared to the. I mean, it just looks as if. I mean. I'm not sure that there's much difference. There's either a very interesting difference between us, which we'd need to unpack, or we're just saying the same thing in slightly different ways.
You might say, sorry, if I last come in, you want to speak on the other side. You could say that in some ways, I mean, I think I see many critiques as building on one another in some way. You could say that maybe freedom, which is actually what I think is crucial precondition for any discussion of self-focused freedom is a precondition for possibly theoretical reasons. It doesn't actually spell it out in first critique. And that it's actually, when my book talks about the Nietzschean notion of self, it's actually that Kant somehow doesn't think that the self is a problem. He assumes that he says there's a containment between reason and freedom, between capital and freedom, and freedom, but he doesn't think about that stuff. He doesn't think about it in the way the first Kant is doing.
Yes.
And I think in some ways, and so maybe, and I don't know, that's maybe a point I don't know if you agree on, but I just want to say also that there is surely a way of separating out. I mean, for me, it's clear that obviously the crucial thing here, and maybe we'll be surprised about that, but for me, it's useful. I think you can raise a question about the self. When you describe what the self is, what you know about that self, and also what the self does. When Molly talks about the project of the self needing us being the only kind of being for which the nature of our being is a question for us. And, you know, when it's actually Hegel who says, first of all, and of course after Freud, everybody says this, that we need to treat ourselves as though we are the neighbour, but that's to do with how we value ourselves in relation to the value of others. But that's a different question from what the self actually is, which
yes.
becomes very complicated in relation to which other, some big other, some actual human other.
Yes.
There are two different questions that Kant doesn't think about, because the self is the character in 13 aspects, the self is the real self, but what else? And he doesn't think about the question that all the Kantians are really posing in a big way, that what the self is.
That's right, and there's a sense in which he thinks that to the extent that the question about what the self is would be a question about where did freedom come from, he thinks, and the groundwork ends, famously with his saying, well, We can't understand that, we can't ask about that, because that would be precisely to do with Christ's metaphysics, the first critique. But we can understand why we don't need to understand that. We can, and that, of course, is going to be a drag for various other post-Kantian philosophers. But it is interesting, I think there is itself, because if you think of it as well, that for Kant, practical reason just is, on some level, in the critique of practical reason, the process of producing goodwill. So, in some sense, all we're concerned with are the reasons people give for actions. So to the extent that you've got a reason-giving entity, that's all the self need be. And it leads to all sorts of interesting... I mean, when the Levinasian critique there would come in and say, well, that's right, so to love the self and to love your neighbour as yourself is in some sense to love the moral law that you have access to, and that, as you were, that permits you to will a universal law that, as it were, the other one. So there's a strange sense in which there's a symmetry. The productive asymmetry in Kant is an interior one, whereas for Levinas it's got to be this exterior one. And maybe that's maybe there's more of that in Kierkegaard, actually. I'm not sure. It's interesting.
Well, we've run out of time, but we'll get to the bar, so if anyone has anything else they'd like to say, stay in there. But
thank you for your question.
Thank you, Paul, for an excellent talk. Thank you. So we'll get to the bar. We've booked a table for 5 at the Devonshire, so that's room for 2 people at least to come. Well, at most, in fact. So if anyone wants to come for dinner with us, 7.